Well, welcome to the Outdoor Citizen. Thanks for listening. This is episode 47. Your host is Marty Jones, and as a guest today, we have Mr. Ethan Green from the Colorado Avalanche Information Center. As always, we want to be sure to thank Don Richmond for the music that you hear during the podcast, and Daniel Boyce for the sounds of the valley's birds. So welcome. Ethan Green is the director of the Colorado Avalanche Information Center, or CAIC. Thanks for joining us today, Ethan.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here with you.
To get started, could you give us just a little bit of a background, where you're from, how you got involved in the Avalanche Information Center, and what kind of experience you have in the backcountry?
Well, I can do that. It's not a short story, but I'll try to give you a short version of it. So I grew up on the Front Range in Boulder, Colorado. And I moved to Telluride right after high school to pursue skiing and being in the mountains. I had already learned a little bit about avalanches, but I learned a little bit more there. And got interested in avalanches, you know, more in a professional sense, mostly for my own safety, but then, you know, to help others. And bounced around the West a little bit, and ended up back in Fort Collins doing grad school, and that's when I started working for the CAIC. That was in 2005. And I've been working with the group ever since.
How long have you been the director of the Avalanche Information Center?
I started as the director, so I've been the director since 2005.
That's a pretty long tenure.
It is, yeah. The guy before me, Knox Williams, who some of your listeners might be familiar with, he did it for 25 years. And I got a couple more years before I get into that range, but closer than I thought I was going to be when I started the job.
Right. And it's really good to have stability in that position, because this is a very important center for the safety of people who like to get out into the mountains in the wintertime. Could you give us a brief history of the Colorado Avalanche Information Center?
Well, the center started actually in the Forest Service. In the kind of mid-60s, the Forest Service started a research program at the Rocky Mountain Research Station in Fort Collins on snow and avalanches. And that really encompassed a lot of different aspects of snow, including avalanches. Some folks there got interested in the public warning side. So not just the research side, but how do we talk to people about this hazard throughout Colorado, and how do we create a program that helps people deal with avalanche safety in that kind of public sphere. And so in 1973, they started putting out daily forecasts of the avalanche hazard. And Knox Williams, who I mentioned, was one of the people there. Art Judson was the other founding member. And that was the Colorado Avalanche Warning Program. And it was in the Forest Service, let's see, until the late 70s. Then it moved from the research side of the Forest Service into the administrative side, so more the side that would deal with recreation. In 1983, the Forest Service cut the funding, and Knox brought the center to the state of Colorado, into the Department of Natural Resources, where it is today. So we've been part of the Colorado state government in different parts of the Colorado Department of Natural Resources since 1983.
That's a nice history for the CAIC. Why is it important to forecast and observe avalanches? And why is it important to do it on a regular basis, a daily basis?
Well, like a lot of natural hazards, it really just depends on the type of impact that it's having on the people, the economy, whatever folks care about. In Colorado, we have a lot of mountains, and we have a lot of people that are living in the mountains. We have a lot of tourism and other businesses that are affected by moving through the mountains. And so avalanches really impact a lot of our lives for the folks that are living, working, and playing in the Colorado mountains. And unlike other parts of the Western United States, we have all of these transportation corridors, and again, towns, municipalities that are in the mountains, and not just next to places where you're going to have avalanches, but really intertwined. So there's a lot of aspects of our lives, moving goods and services, where we build things, businesses that are taking people into the mountains, whether that's for recreation or some other aspect, that are all impacted by avalanches. And so that's why having a group in Colorado that really looks at avalanche hazard and avalanche safety across the state is really helpful. One of the things that we didn't talk about in the history of the CAIC is the partnership with the Department of Transportation. And that happened after a couple of accidents in the Ouray-Silverton area in the late 80s and early 90s. And the CDOT decided that they really needed this statewide program to look at the avalanche hazard for the highways, and partnered with the CAIC to do that. And since 92, I believe, we've been forecasting the avalanche hazard for the state and federal highways around the state that CDOT manages, and working with them to both safeguard the maintenance workers, people that are taking care of the roads, and then also reducing the hazard for the traveling public as well. And so that's just a good example of how having one group that's focused on avalanches can deal with all the different aspects that impact our lives, whether it's transportation and the economy, whether it's supporting outdoor recreation, whether it's supporting people that are doing their own personal recreation, you know, going into the backcountry for snowmobiling or skiing or climbing. And there's just so much of that that's happening over so many different parts of our state. That's one of the reasons I think the center is really plays an important role in all of our lives and in many different communities around the state.
And, you know, I moved from the border of Minnesota and North Dakota in 1989 to Colorado. And up there, the conditions of the snow didn't change very much from one day to the next or within a given day time. And we discovered after coming to Colorado that, boy, the snow conditions can change a whole lot in the span of just a day or 2 days. And I suspect that that's one reason why it's so important for you to do these forecasts on a daily basis.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, it's one of the really neat things about Colorado. We refer to different areas of the Western United States in terms of snow climates, how the snow behaves in these different areas, and what are some of the driving factors that lead to different types of avalanche cycles. And Colorado, because it's pretty far away from an ocean, and it's pretty high up in elevation, it's generally cold, it's windy, we have a continental snow climate. And what part of the aspect of that is that we have these rapidly changing conditions within the snow, and we also form layers within the snowpack that can produce avalanches for us for sometimes weeks and months. And so we tend not to see avalanche cycles driven completely by, you know, big storm events like a big storm rolling off of the ocean. We tend to see weaknesses that exist in the snowpack that will sort of crop up over days and weeks as we get different loading events, wind events. And so it really is a fairly dynamic system. And it's one of the reasons, like you said, that it's important that we continually update the advice that we're giving people. We try to give them as good advice as we can with as much lead time as possible. But things are changing rapidly. And so people need to check the forecast every single day before they're going into the backcountry.
And I know that you guys don't have 3,000 employees for CAIC. This is a big state, lots of mountainous terrain. How is it possible for you to make good forecasts on a regular basis? What kind of advances have occurred? What kind of sensoring do you have, or sensors do you have, to be able to accomplish this?
Well, you're right. We're a pretty small group. We're 30 people spread across. We're monitoring around 28,000 square miles of mountainous terrain every day. And The way that we do it is we get a lot of help. We get help from the ski areas, from mountain guiding communities, from different folks in CDOT, County Road and Bridge, public that are going into the backcountry. Everybody sends us information that we sort out so that we can try to paint these pictures of what's happening across the state and give that information back to people. So we are out in the field looking at the snow every single day. And we also get information from a lot of other people, and that combination is extremely important. As far as you know, how things have changed, it's sort of an interesting mix of we're still doing things in a lot of ways very similar to how we did them years ago, but we do have some new technology, and we have really, you know, now 50 years of increasing knowledge across the globe and here in Colorado that helps us do a better job. One of the things that we've implemented kind of in your area is on Wolf Creek Pass, we've put in an infrasonic sensing system. So infrasound is just sound waves, but it's at a lower frequency than what the human ear can hear. But avalanches will make a signal in that that infrasonic range. And so we're working with a company actually in Boise to tune the system in that area so that we can monitor avalanche activity in some of the paths that run down onto the highway. So, you know, that's something that's it really started actually with a research project on Red Mountain Pass in the 90s. But it's not until recently that we've been able to work to try to get it into an operational tool that helps us increase public safety along US 160.
Wow, that's cool. Are there more of those infrasonic sensors scattered throughout the state?
This is the first place that we have them in Colorado. There's a few places in other parts of the western U.S., Little Cottonwood Canyon, Teton Pass in Wyoming, that are using them as well.
Well, thank you. We appreciate taking care of the San Juans and South Central Colorado very much. So what's the day-to-day life of a Colorado avalanche forecaster?
Well, I'm sure you can appreciate the answer. There isn't really a typical day. And it depends a little bit on what people's roles are in the center. Of course, we have, you know, a management team, and that's what I'm part of. We have forecasters that are focused on highways. We have forecasters that are focused on backcountry areas. And we're all sort of, because we're that small group, we're moving information around, we're helping each other out. So it's kind of a dynamic system. If people are in the office, we start at 4 a.m. So we have someone who comes in at 4 a.m. and looks at the weather, makes sure that the forecasts are as good as they possibly can be for people that day. And that's they check out of there about 8 o'clock. We have another team that comes in throughout the day that you know, looks at all the observations that are out there, looks at some of the numerical models that we're running or that the weather service is running, and then we put out that backcountry forecast in the afternoon, and you know, get it out to people about 4:30. For the highway folks, you know, they're driving the corridors, they're going out and looking at the snowpack. We also have backcountry forecasters, if they're not running an office shift, which they do office shifts about 8 days a month, the other, you know, 20 days or so, they're in the field and they're identifying areas where we have some uncertainty, where we feel like if we collect a little bit more data, we'll be able to refine our image of what's happening in the backcountry and provide better advice for people. So they're going out measuring the snow. That could be looking at variations in snow depth, looking at trends in wind drifting, or it could be digging down into the snow to look at the profile of the layers that develop and doing some mechanical tests so we have some idea of how much additional load it's going to take to actually produce an avalanche. And a lot of what we're doing is pattern recognition. So we're looking at trends in terms of location. Is it just the San Juans? Is it the Elks? Is it the Park Range? And are we seeing problems everywhere throughout that one of those ranges, or is it just on slopes that face northeast and maybe only slopes that are above 10,000 feet? So we're painting these pictures every day, and then we're going out to collect data to try to refine them and make them better each day.
In the San Luis Valley, we have all these little microclimates, sometimes even within the boundaries of a given city. It can be raining on one side of Alamosa and not on the other, for example. And because of these microclimates in the valley, I'm sure that must extend up into the mountains as well. Is it challenging to be able to forecast for one set of mountains, one range, as opposed to another? Do all the ranges within Colorado have their own peculiar characteristics, or are there some similarities that allow you to use models that are similar in each range?
Well, both are true. So all the places in Colorado have their own unique personalities, as you're describing. And depending on, you know, what scale you're looking at, if you're trying to look at a mountain range or a drainage or maybe even just one side of a peak, you know, you may see some differences and I want to say peculiarities, but that's not exactly the right word. It's just unique impacts or aspects of some of these different places. But the physics that drive the snow and the weather are the same throughout. So we can use the same models for different parts of Colorado. We just drive them with those sort of unique characteristics that we know about. And some of that is actually the data collection that we go out and participate in. But like you're talking about, there's some pretty small variations that can happen around the state. And so the way that we deal with that is depending on what application, what is the avalanche forecast gonna get used for? So when we're talking about the highways, we have identified specific avalanche paths that are gonna threaten a particular roadway, and we can really focus in on those areas. And typically they're in kind of clusters, and so we can sort of look and we get familiar with some of those local variations, and we can account for those, both in terms of instrumentation and experience and modeling. All of that sort of goes together. For the vast backcountry areas, we understand a lot of what's happening at those smaller scales, but the descriptions that we make are at a much wider scale. So they are kind of a broad brush of what's happening over fairly large areas. We back that up with specific observations in small areas, and so that people can read those broad descriptions and then look at specific data from weather stations, from people in the field, and try to downscale things to the area that they're actually going into, because they're gonna eventually have to make slope scale decisions based off of more regional scale advice that we're giving them.
And what are some of the biggest challenges for forecasting avalanches?
Well, the list is pretty long. You know, there's part of it is just getting an idea of what's happening in the mountain areas. A lot of what we're doing is pattern recognition, looking at where avalanches are happening and thinking about similar areas where they may happen. A lot of the data collection that we do is along places where you can see very easily. So driving along roads, climbing out of mountain valleys to the first ridge lines in a lot of these places and looking over and seeing what's happening. But there is vast areas within the state that are really hard to see that way. And so when we're trying to collect avalanche occurrence data, where are the avalanches happening? What are the characteristics of these slopes? And try to turn that into a pattern we can describe to people, we're missing a large part of that pie just because we can't see everything, or if there's a extended storm period, we may not be able to see what's happening on all of the slopes in all of these different areas. So there's a bit of interpolation that we do to take the data that we have, targeted areas where we know we can collect data that will help us talk about some of these areas that we can't get into or can't see because of the weather, and that difference between the data we have and the data we would like to have to make these predictions is probably our biggest challenge.
So we're coming off an El Nino year, and according to NOAA, maybe heading into a La Nina year. What does that mean in terms of avalanche season?
Well, using El Nino and La Nina is a little challenging for avalanche forecasting. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that El Nino and La Nina can tell us something about kind of seasonal temperatures and seasonal precipitation. And that's really important for avalanches, but it doesn't get us the whole way because the avalanche conditions on any particular day are a combination of the weather that we've gotten from when the snow fell to that day, and then the weather that we're actually having on that day. So it's both the history of the weather and the current weather. And so the timing of how these events happen and how they come in is extremely important for avalanches. So we could have a dry winter, but all of the precipitation comes in a couple week period, and that would produce a really bad avalanche season. Or we could have a dry winter and all of the snow comes in little trickles a few inches at a time, and we don't see very many avalanches. And of course, the same is true for a wet winter. So using La Nina and El Nino, it's useful, but it really doesn't get us as far as we would like to go to make predictions. The other reason is that Colorado's in kind of the middle of North America, and La Nina and El Nino have a pretty good skill in predicting seasonal precipitation in the Pacific Northwest and the desert Southwest. And we're right in the middle. And so the skill is just not as good for us. That is a little bit different for the southern mountains of Colorado because they are a little closer to that desert Southwest. And so if you have, we tend to see drier conditions in the southern mountains with La Nina. We may be seeing that right now. But if that's kind of the center of those dry conditions in the desert Southwest is a little bit further south, then the southern mountains may still get a decent amount of precipitation. Or if it's a little further north, then the southern mountains are going to be dry. And so we look at La Nina and El Nino, and like you said, we are moving into kind of a weak La Nina period, which would point towards drier conditions in the southern mountains of Colorado. But we don't have enough confidence in that correlation to really hang our hat on it.
You've been the CAIC director for almost 20 years now. Have you, during that time, noticed any avalanche trends, either in increasing or decreasing numbers, or is it just too up in the air?
Well, that's a very good question. And like most good questions, there's some complexity there. So the way that we track avalanches is really just by traveling around the state and observing them. So we have numbers of we have data on avalanche activity over many, many years in Colorado, but we also know that those numbers are flawed because they dictate on, you know, how much we can see and how much we can get around. So we do track things from year to year, and we are seeing a little bit of an uptake, but that uptake could be just that we have more people out in the backcountry, more public observations, people writing in and telling us things. We have seen some changes in weather and weather patterns. The easiest one to talk about, I think, is rain on snow events. So when I was a kid, growing up in Colorado, going to the mountains and skiing, like, we did not see rain in the midwinter in Colorado. It was too high, it's too cold. We just didn't see those events. We are starting to see rain on snow events in the middle of the winter in Colorado now, even up to fairly high elevations in the heart of the mountain. So that's a change that has happened within my lifetime. We're also seeing the impact of some of these more intense precipitation events, atmospheric river events that people talk about. Mostly we would talk about those in years past as impacting the Sierra, you know, some of the coastal ranges in California, up towards the Cascades in Washington and Oregon. But we're seeing some of those penetrate into Colorado now and produce pretty warm and very wet precipitation events. And we saw one over Thanksgiving of this year. And those are having a big impact both on the snowpack, but also the avalanche conditions, in Colorado. Those are some of the big ones.
Great. So what kind of traffic are you getting from people coming to your website, checking out avalanche conditions before they go into the backcountry? Is it a sufficient number, do you think, compared to the number of people who don't check the website?
Well, I want everyone to check the website. So until everyone that's going into the backcountry in Colorado is checking the website before their trip for the day, I would say that the traffic is insufficient. But we have seen pretty big increases and steady increases in the people that are using the website. Also our social media feeds. We have a mobile phone application as well. And there's also some third-party groups, like some of the mapping software, like Onyx and Caltopo and Gaia, that are putting out or taking our information and displaying it as part of their platform. So there's a lot of ways for people to get that information. We just added it to the Colorado Parks and Wildlife's Cotrex phone app, which is a great way to get information on trails, and now you can get the avalanche forecast there. So hopefully there's lots of ways that people can get that information, and I'd really encourage them to do that, because like you were talking about before, the conditions are changing day to day, and so you really, just like checking the weather forecast before you go out, you should be checking the avalanche forecast in the wintertime to make sure that your plan for the day is appropriate for the conditions of the day.
So if there's a group of backcountry enthusiasts who are getting ready to go out, say, on a Wednesday at 2 in the afternoon, I don't know why they would go at that time. What is the best time, what is the best day and time for that group to check to get the most current data?
Well, it really depends on when they're making plans. So they should check for the current forecast for when they're building their plan to make sure that that their plan is appropriate for the time period that they're going out. And then they should also check it just before they go out to make sure that nothing has changed. We update the backcountry forecast every day about 4:30. And we put out a danger rating for all the areas in all the areas in Colorado for 2 days. So on Tuesday afternoon, we'll put out a forecast for Wednesday, and that also covers Thursday. And so every afternoon, we will update that so that you have good information, hopefully for planning the night before you go out. But if we see something has changed, no matter when it is, 24 hours a day, we will update things. So if we put out a forecast on Tuesday afternoon, folks going out planning to go out on Wednesday could check it Tuesday afternoon and make a plan. And then if we see something changing on Wednesday morning, we're going to change it. And so if they check it, if they're going out at 2 o'clock on Wednesday, if they check it at noon, they'll probably have the most current information. And that is really the most important thing, because they're going to have to take that information and apply it to the area that they're going to. And so you really want to make sure you have the best information possible.
And what is that mobile app that you were talking about?
So there's a couple where you can get the avalanche forecast. We have one in partnership with the Friends of the CAIC, which is a nonprofit group that supports us. And if you go to the Android or Apple stores, Google stores, and just search on CAIC, you'll find it. The other one that I was talking about is an app that Colorado Parks and Wildlife puts out. It's called Cotrex. That's Cotrex, I believe. And it has information, really good information for any kind of recreation that you're doing in the state, winter and summer. So it's got maps, it's got trails, there'll be information on trail closures there. You can get a weather forecast through it, and now you can get the avalanche forecast as well. So that's a really good resource for folks, whether they're hunting, fishing, skiing, snowmobiling, whatever you're doing in the state. That's a great app.
So for our listeners who may be planning a backcountry trip, you have no excuses. You've got several ways that you can get the Avalanche Information Center data. So please, before you go out, go to the CAIC website or download that app on your mobile device so that you can be best prepared for dealing with the conditions that you find.
Our website is colorado.gov/avalanche.
Okay, thank you very much. Any final thoughts, Ethan?
Great to be here with you. People can contact us at our website, colorado.gov/avalanche. It's a great resource for all things dealing with avalanches, information on avalanche safety, and of course you can get the forecast that we're updating every afternoon throughout the winter.
Thank Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Ethan Green, the director of the Colorado Avalanche Information Center. Thanks a lot, Ethan, and have a great winter. We'll be right back with some outdoor news after this brief sponsor break.
Hey everyone, this is Hannah Eubanks with the Valley Calendar, bringing you events that stretch from Creed to Fort Garland. Christmas is this week. Alamosa Citizen hopes you have a wonderful holiday. Because it is holiday week and we are heading into the new year, there aren't many events in the last days of 2024. 2025, however, is already booming with events. Here's what's happening in January thus far. On January 11th, meet Julie Bell, author of the Colorado History Mystery Series at the Alamosa Public Library. Society Hall rings in the new year with Tish Hinojosa on Sunday, January 12th, and Alexa Wildish and Ingrid Avison on January 24th. If your New Year's resolution is anything to the tune of getting fit, getting into running, embracing Valley culture, or jumping into freezing cold water while everyone watches, then the Rio Frio Ice Fest is your jam. This year's theme is Welcome to the Jungle. The end of January is chock full of events from the annual Rio Frio Ice Fest, so be sure to watch out for those. To join in on the race, head to rioraces.com. If you have an event coming up, submit it to the Valley Calendar. All you have to do is head to the Valley Calendar page on alamosacitizen.com, click online form, and give us the details. This has been Hannah Eubanks. That's all for now. See you next year.
The Rio Grande cutthroat trout will not be placed on the endangered species list. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced recently that after nearly three decades of review, assessment, and reassessment, the fish is not in danger of becoming extinct for now or in the foreseeable future. Biologists from Colorado have added 94 populations of pure Rio Grande cutthroats to 239 miles of stream through chemical reclamations and habitat and connectivity enhancements. The Rio Grande cutthroat trout is one of 14 subspecies of cutthroat trout. It can be found in high elevation streams and lakes of the Rio Grande, Canadian, and Pecos River drainages in Colorado and New Mexico, making it the southernmost cutthroat trout. Currently, the fish only occupies 12% of its historic habitat in about 800 miles of streams. Biologists estimate that 127 conservation populations now exist in the two states, and 57 of those populations are considered to be secure. This decision is in response to all of our hard work between all of our partners, the whole Rio Grande cutthroat conservation team. This is a win for all of us and shows we're working hard to conserve the species without making that federal protection necessary and that we are making gains for the species. The decision to not list the Rio Grande cutthroat doesn't mean we can stop. It just means we are on the right track, said CPW aquatic biologist Estevan Vigil. The next round of gray wolves are being prepared for capture and release into Colorado's wilds. As Colorado Parks and Wildlife prepares to head to Canada here in the near future, it is approaching the next release with more caution and with the livestock owner more in mind. The State Wildlife Agency recently released details on a plan that is promising to be more proactive than reactive. Through the hiring of wildlife conflict reduction employees and creating a robust range riding program, livestock owners should feel more at ease. Yet the intersection of livestock and wolves will continue to be a point of contention that is resulting in further calls for collaboration or for far more regulation. At the state level, the Joint Budget Committee is signaling a potential resolution to delay the next release of wolves to save the state $2.1 million out of its nearly $1 billion deficit coming into the 2025-26 budget year. If nothing stalls the next release, Colorado's next wolves will arrive sometime before the end of March 2025. Great Outdoors Colorado has awarded a $352,818 grant to Conejos and Costilla counties to help install interpretive signage and add a concrete boat ramp to access the Rio Grande at Lobatos Bridge, the statewide funding organization announced this week. The two counties, along with the Federal Bureau of Land Management, Sangre de Cristo National Heritage Area, San Luis Valley Great Outdoors, and other partners, have been working to establish the Lobatos Bridge Recreation and Interpretive Area to boost awareness of the historic passageway. GOCO's support to develop the Lobatos Bridge Recreation and Interpretive Education Project helps Costilla County satisfy its priorities for open space by giving residents and visitors new opportunities to enjoy outdoor recreation and enhance the visitor experience of this beautiful landscape gem. By preserving the important stories, local history, and rich culture of this area through education, we ensure future generations will be able to experience and learn the heritage of this unique site in perpetuity, said Lawrence Pacheco, Costilla County Open Space Coordinator. You can read more about each of these news items on alamosacitizen.com. Next up, upcoming outdoor events. The annual Rio Frio Ice Fest is January 24th through 26th, 2025. This year's theme is Welcome to the Jungle. The weekend's events include the cross-country Luminaria ski on the Friday, January 24th, and the polar plunge at Blanca Vista Park on Sunday the 26th, and a 5K race on the frozen Rio Grande on Saturday the 25th. There will also be a downtown full of events like live ice carvings and a bonfire and fire and ice. So to see a full list of all the weekend's events or to register for the Rio Frio race itself, go to rioraces.com. Birders and nature enthusiasts in the San Luis Valley are invited to join participants across the Western Hemisphere for Audubon's longest-running winter tradition, the annual Christmas Bird Count. This year, the event will be held at the Great Sand Dunes National Park and Preserve on Tuesday, December 31st, starting at 7:45 a.m. Volunteers of all skill levels and ages are welcome and encouraged to take part. To join the bird count at Great Sand Dunes, individuals must register as park volunteers. Contact park biologist Dwayne Mosher at 719-378-6363, or you can send an email to dewane_mosher@nps.gov to sign up. Registered volunteers will receive a waiver for the park entrance fee on the day of the event. Volunteers under age 18 must be accompanied by an adult. All participants are required to arrive at the park at 7:45 a.m. to complete necessary paperwork, review safety guidelines, and receive maps and instructions for their assigned areas. Participants are encouraged to bring their own binoculars and spotting scopes. A limited number of these items may be available for borrowing. The 7th annual Rio Grande State of the Basin Symposium was announced for Saturday, March 29th, 2025. The Rio Grande State of the Basin Symposium brings together leaders and community members from throughout the San Luis Valley and the state of Colorado to discuss issues related to the Rio Grande Basin's natural and cultural resources. It will be an all-day event starting at 8:30 a.m. and going till 6 p.m. at Richardson Hall on the Adams State University campus. And you'll learn more about this as we get closer to that March 29th date. This ends this episode of the Outdoor Citizen Podcast. We'll be back in January to start a whole new year of outdoor adventures. The Outdoor Citizen is supported by SLV Great Outdoors and is produced and edited by Owen Wood. Thank you, Owen. If you have an outdoor adventure you'd like to share, or if there are topics you'd like to hear in a future episode, send an email to info@alamosacitizen.com. As always, we want to thank Don Richmond for his song Sea Turtle and Daniel Boyce for the sounds of the valley's birds. Since this is our last podcast before the end of the year, the Outdoor Citizen would like to take this opportunity to wish everyone a happy holiday season, safe recreating if you go outdoors, and we encourage you to go outdoors. Even in the wintertime, you can always dress appropriately for the weather. Get out, enjoy the snow, the birds, the animals, and take time for yourself. Happy holidays, everyone. This has been Marty Jones with the Outdoor Citizen. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you outdoors.